Session number 10599, Reel 9.
Major I, English, Reel 9. What was happening on your right with the Maori battalion this time, Major?
Well, we could hear them. We could hear fighting and shouting going on the right, but we had no knowledge at all of how they were getting on and whether they were successful in in getting this place. We just carried on following the barrage.
You hadn't come under fire from small arms at this time.
We came, yes. We were at this point, we German machine gun on the right started firing tracer, and this scared some of the men. And then we pointed out to them that we could see the tracer, and they were going over our heads, so there was nothing to worry about. And that didn't bother us at all. We could also hear A and B companies ahead carrying out their attack, and they're using their automatic weapons. Now, I found that short halts were essential to keep everyone together and keep them in a proper line and see that there was no straggling. And useful also for Private Davis to check on his on the direction, and meanwhile, of course, Corley was counting his paces. We came across several dead Germans and Italians, obviously the work of the of our barrage, and we began to collect prisoners. And it's curious, really, how inexperienced, anyway, British soldiers tend to gawp at German prisoners as if they were sort of men from Mars, and sort of gather around and instead of getting on with the job. And this had to be checked. And there were two men in 13 platoon who were wounded, and I sent these prisoners back with the wounded men. And then we came across a tank. An Italian tank about 50 yards away, and I tried to get the 13 platoon to move round to the right to attack it and get nearer with its 68 grenades, but the tank fired at them, and that stopped that. And then we got 14 platoon, San Martin was the platoon sergeant, and he fired his 68 grenade at this thing, and it landed just in the rear of this tank. Anyway, that was enough for the tank to go off, but I was a bit annoyed at the time that we hadn't been able to stop it going off. Now, we were coming obviously into the area of the German headquarters because there was more transport about, and the moon had now risen, and things were easier to see. Out of one of these trucks, a man ran away, and it was then light enough for me to get down on the knee and shoot him with a rifle, which I was carrying. More prisoners were coming in, and we got several out of dugouts, sometimes using our 36 grenades, sometimes they just surrendered. And we came across a Red Cross tent, and a man came out who said he was a doctor, and obviously ordered the troops to leave that alone, and we just let it be as it were, and we passed on. And then at 2:45 we reached what we took to be the first objective, which was codenamed Cherry. And I put up the very signal, which was green, red, green. the The platoon commander, 14th Platoon, Ferry Bullman, reported that two of his sections seemed to have disappeared. So I moved 15th Platoon up from reserve and brought them to take over 14th Platoon's job. We must have arrived on the first objective late, probably because of the incident with the tank, because we only had a quarter of an hour there instead of half an hour. Anyway, we had time to contact A Company, the right hand of A, platoon of A Company, which was now on our left.
Did you get much opportunity to estimate the kind of condition your own men were in a brief stop like this? Or?
Yes. I got the impression that they were okay, they were doing well, their blood was up, and they were using their weapons well. One came to realise after a little bit that we were having the odd casualties, which in some cases one didn't see, and they were thinning out a bit. I mean, we obviously saw some casualties, but so far this had been pretty light. We set off again when the barrage moved forward, and again we found it was necessary to have short halts to keep everyone together, and I'm sure this paid off, because either for that reason or possibly because we were lucky, but C Company was the only company in the battalion actually to arrive on the objective more or less intact. And the men were, as I say, fighting their way forward when they did meet opposition with Brens and rifles, bayonets in some cases, and grenades. We then, a chap carrying a rifle came up, who I didn't know at all, who said he was from A Company, and he seemed a very intelligent, well-spoken sort of chap. Anyway, I said, well, you come along with us. And he had about 10 men with him. This later turned out to be a man an officer who had arrived only shortly before and who I hadn't met, called Lieutenant Worley. So that wasn't that he was just looking like any other soldier, and it wasn't apparent until later on. In the second phase of the attack, we captured about 50 more prisoners, mostly Italians, and again they were taken back by the walking wounded, and also we had been joined by a Maori soldier who'd got detached from his battalion and who just carried on with us, quite happy, carrying a 2-inch mortar, and I thought, well, we really ought to get him back to his own chaps, so I sent him back with the wounded as well. After we'd gone about 35 minutes from the first objective, Corley said that by his reckoning we were just about on the objective. So I said, right, well, we'll go on another 200 yards to make certain we are there. And we realised we must be, because the barrage had halted, and we came up to it and started to consolidate the position. This was at 03:40, and the barrage went on till 4 o'clock, and the silence when it stopped was absolutely amazing. One thought, really, one has almost got used to this constant deafening noise, and then it stopped, and you could see the stars and the moon, and it was a different world. But anyway, we had work to do, and I sent up the success signal for Brandy, which was the final objective, and that was red, green, red with our very lights. Whether anyone saw them or not, I don't know. and allotted platoon positions as best I could in the dark, and told the men that they had to really dig, they never dug before, to get down before dawn. The 18 set operated by Lance Corporal Simpson was an excellent chap. He couldn't get through the battalion, and we didn't know really where anybody else was. Two sensations I remember distinctly. The first was that the fog of war was complete. As far as we knew, we were the only people of the 8th LI in the desert, really. We didn't know where anyone else was. And secondly, the intense desire to lie down and go to sleep. The after the pent-up excitement of the attack, now that the guns had stopped and we were in one place and without going forward, that everyone just wanted to rest. Anyway, we had to... there was absolutely no time for that.
Did you have trouble getting the men to dig in at this stage?
I think they realised that if they were going to have any chance of staying alive the next day, they had to get below ground. And this, of course, is where the picks and shovels came in. And we still had quite a number of Durham pitmen in the battalion, and they knew how to get down. And we were fairly well down by dawn. I sent out contact patrols from 13th platoon and 15th platoon to try and find people on our flanks, but we wouldn't find anybody at night. Then we came, we saw, perhaps it was getting a little bit lighter, but we saw a German half track about 100 yards away, and we went across to investigate this, and the German got out and surrendered. And we also came across quite a number of German prisoners lying in the desert, and two British soldiers, and I realized that these were some of the prisoners we'd taken earlier, who had been sent to the rear and had been shot at and wouldn't go any farther. And apparently one of the men said, well, things quietened down a bit, and we went on a bit more, and then they were shot at again, and they won't go anywhere now. These chaps are just lying still in the desert. Then, as time went on, we began to hear the roar of tank engines. And this was a very heartening sight, because because there seemed to be so many of them. And tanks came up on our left. And the leading tank was just moving forward fairly slowly when, bang, it went up in flames. And then three more. And this is really a ghastly sight. And it was obvious that there was still a screen of German 88s. And when we thought about it, we realized that the tanks were silhouetted against the dawn, and the Germans had marvelous targets. And I think within 200 or 300 yards of our company positions, there were 20 tanks hit in about half an hour. And not many men seemed to get out of the tanks. This, of course, was the 9th Armoured Brigade trying to push through. And I think that day they lost certainly over 90 tanks in the brigade. As things got lighter, our guns started shelling the German 88s, which is really a AK-AK gun, and adapted by the Germans to anti-tank. And it's a great big gun, and it takes a lot of concealing. And they probably hadn't had time to do that, and they were fairly big targets. As it got light, I could see that the positions, fortunately, the platoon positions, it seemed to be all right. The chaps had good fields of fire, and they were dug in fairly well. We could see the Sidi Abdelrahman track just in front of us, about 150 yards in front, and the mosque of Sidi Abdelrahman itself up on slightly higher ground to the right. This, I'm sure, was a German OP. Then, or perhaps earlier, we saw a great big mound, and this was in fact sandbags concealing an 88. And so, as soon as we realised this, we fired at it with 2-inch mortars, and the crew ran out, tried to get to their trenches, but we shot 3 of them with Bren guns, and the rest of them surrendered. So at least that was one left, one less to shoot at our tanks. The Germans, of course, artillery started getting going, and we had quite a bit of shelling from that. Then a Sherman tank, most of the tanks we'd seen so far were Grants and Crusaders, and there were a few Shermans, which was the new tank being issued to the British Army. That Sherman came up firing its Beza and moving forward, and then that got a tremendous crack from the gun on the left and went up in flames, and this was about 20 yards from our position, and only the driver managed to stagger out and collapsed on the ground, and he was dreadfully burned. And 2 or 3 of our chaps went out and brought him in. And we were gradually collecting wounded at company headquarters, including the A Company platoon that attached to us. Their platoon sergeant, Sergeant Moody, he was one of them. And we didn't really have slit trenches to put them in. And the poor chaps were in a poor way, and as the day wear on, the flies got terrible in the heat, and it was a major problem, really. I mean, we'd done them up with field dressings and that sort of thing, and that's as much as we could do. About mid-morning, about 10 German tanks approached our positions. They got within about 200 yards. Mark 3s and Mark 4 tanks, and also one of the new Mark 4 specials, which had an immensely long 75mm gun on it. And by that time, Corporal Simpson had got the 18 set going with the battalion, so we reported this. And we had no anti-tank guns, they hadn't got up to us, but so the men got their 68 grenades ready, those that we hadn't used. And fortunately, the tanks never came nearer than 150 yards. They fired at us quite a bit, but we were fairly well down. And one realised, of course, that there was all the British tanks behind, that they didn't approach any nearer. In a bit of a lull, I sent Private Davis, intelligence man, back. He'd done his job. Sent him back to battalion headquarters with a message that if possible, could we get some sort of a vehicle up to evacuate the wounded, and also if we could get some anti-tank guns up, we'd feel happier. And then at about 11 o'clock we had a demonstration by the RAF. They had what everyone termed the Terrible 18, which was 18 light bombers, mostly Bostons and Mitchells and Baltimores, and they would come over in close formation, and we could see them. Presumably the leader gave the word, and you could see the bombs coming down, glinting in the sun, and then crashing down on the German positions. And their accuracy was tremendous. I mean, the German positions were maybe 400 yards from us, and I think it was only one bomb came anywhere near us, and the rest were or right on them. And virtually every 40 minutes they came over. And after about 3 or 4 hours of this, there was about 150 Germans got up and walked across the desert to mostly to 60 Allein, and gave themselves up. And I think you could understand it. They probably weren't dug well enough into the ground either. And but the things were definitely improving. I think the company spirit was good. After those terrible tank losses, things seemed to have quietened down. The gunners were shooting well, and we thought we were doing all right.
Had you any estimate of your own losses at this time?
Well, I thought then that maybe about 20.
And how was your company disposed in this period?
Well, we had two companies, two platoons forward, 15 and 13, and then to the rear and watching to the right, 14 platoon, which had several casualties, and these men from A Company. And my company headquarters about in the middle. Then we saw an interesting demonstration. There was an 88 towed by a half track with a crew in the half track, came down a bit of a rise, going as fast as it could, and turned left across the front, and I reported it on the 18 set. But of course everyone else had seen it, and both the gunners and the tank gunners shot at this thing, but the thing kept moving. The shells were all around it and it kept going. Anyway, eventually one shell hit the half track, so that gun never came into action. The men had been carrying their packet of biscuits and a tin of bully, which we always carried, and we suggested, well, so we weren't going to go hungry, because no vehicle could come up to us. But we were getting a bit short of ammunition, particularly grenades. About soon after midday, I think early afternoon, Private Davis arrived in the position again, having had a pretty hairy and scary trek across from battalion headquarters, with orders that C Company should withdraw. Well, I was surprised at this. I thought our position was reasonably secure and was quite happy to stay there, but he said that C Company was too exposed and should withdraw to conform more to the positions of 60 Allein and 90 Allein. Well, this withdrawal worried me, because the men had to go across an open desert, and I didn't think it was going to be a very nice operation at all. Anyway, I ordered 14 platoon and the A Company lot to go first, followed by 13, 15 platoon, open order, leaving their Bren guns to the last. And I ordered Harry Welsh, who was 13 platoon commander, to be in charge of the operation, back to battalion headquarters, to personally tell the CO that it was absolutely essential that we got something up to evacuate these wounded if most of them weren't going to die. I decided to stay with the wounded, and Private Corley stayed with me. I counted the company then, and there were between 50 and 60. So we'd probably lost about 30 men, 30, 35 men. As it happened, the withdrawal went off without any incident. There was a bit of shelling of them, but nothing, no casualties, and they just got down and then moved on again as soon as it stopped. Anyway, Corley and I had a what seemed to be an interminable wait. In actual fact, I think it was only about an hour and a half. And then a carrier flying a Red Cross flag was Lieutenant Wally Greenwood. He was second in command of the anti-tank platoon. That came up, and a jeep driven by a New Zealand sergeant. And we loaded the men onto these vehicles. And while we were doing this, we had aid by Stukas, which is Junkers 87 dive bombers. And that didn't improve things much. But in fact, we didn't have any casualties. It was just a lot of dust and noise. But of course, the men, being lying there wounded, were just scared stiff. Whatever, we come to that. And also, we got a bit of firing from our own tanks. But that didn't go on for very long. Anyway, we got back to battalion headquarters, and I eventually was shown our new area when the men were already fairly well dug in. I learnt about some casualties, one of whom was, of course, my second-in-command, Ian Turnbull, who no one had seen since we crossed the start line.
Had he been wounded early in the action?
His case was a mystery for a long time. He was just reported missing. No one had seen him wounded. And he is now, his grave is now marked an unknown Durham Light Infantry officer. And I think he must have had a shell to himself. But he just disappeared off the face of the earth. But we didn't know that then, at that time. But and there had been a number of other officer casualties, and indeed other ranks too, of course. We heard then that the 60 alive were to relieve 8 DLI that night. And then later, those orders were cancelled, and we were told that the New Zealand Brigade was to relieve the whole of the 151 Brigade at midnight. And so these orders were passed down to the men, and they were welcomed, I think, undoubtedly. I also told the chaps I thought they'd done very well in the attack. And indeed, the CO had said the same thing. Just before dark, the tanks, what was left of 9th Armoured Brigade, moved back. And whether it was that, or whether it was just an evening sort of hate by the German artillery, I don't know, but they laid down the heaviest concentration of artillery fire on us for about half an hour. Certainly heavier than anything we'd experienced in the whole battle. In fact, we had more casualties from that than we'd had all day. And eventually the tanks moved off, and frankly, we were glad to see them. While this was going on, there was just a bit of a lull, and I wanted to give some instructions. A 15 platoon went over to see Busty Roberts, platoon commander, and the shelling started again, and I leapt into the nearest slit trench, which was the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Appleby, and landed on top of him, and we lay there for a bit.